Coming up on this episode...
With this platform had a historic win, and she became for a time the most famous woman in the world. She said, I am the first, but I will not be the last.
Jobs that required more than two or four hands, that really imbued her with this sense of grassroots democracy.
Simply a protest vote, right? She must have known there was no way.
It was a conscience vote.
Yeah.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections. Hosted by your two favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own ideas and thoughts about just what gives these works the narrative edge.
All right, Orlando, it's your book today. Who do we got?
Today, we're going to talk about a trailblazing woman who has some surprising connections to Georgia, and we're going to talk about why she deserves to be more than just a trivia question.
A trivia question. Okay, so why is she more than just kind of a Jeopardy clue here?
Well, you know, if you had asked me before this book, who was the first woman elected to Congress, I probably would not be able to tell you her name. I couldn't tell you her name.
Yeah. I couldn't either right now, to be honest.
I probably could tell you that she was from the West. I might have guessed Wyoming, but I would have been wrong. She was from Montana. But, you know, in reading this book, I found out a lot about Jeanette Rankin. Jeanette Rankin, the first woman elected to Congress, and the book we're going to talk about today is called Winning the Earthquake, How Jeanette Rankin Defied All Odds to Become the First Woman in Congress by Larissa Reinhart.
So, Jeanette Rankin, when was she elected to Congress?
So she was elected to Congress in 1916, but the...
So that's before women had the right to vote.
Yeah, the 19th Amendment was 1920.
20. Yeah, but 1916, she convinced enough men who had the power to vote to vote for her.
Well, actually, she convinced men and women because Montana had given women the right to vote in 1914.
Oh, okay.
And Jeanette Rankin was a part of that. So we go back all the way to the beginning of her life when she was born to a rancher family. She was not a pioneer coming to the West on a wagon, but her parents were. And she sort of lives in this world where everybody has to share equally the tasks of a ranch. And so she learns about collectivism and getting along with people and talking to men. So that's how she sort of becomes an advocate and eventually campaigns for women's suffrage in Montana, but all across the West.
It was a time when everybody had to do everything. So, you know, if you're on a homestead with, you know, your wife and your wife gives birth, you're going to be helping deliver that baby and you're going to help take care of that baby. But then if it's harvest time and you're a woman, you have to be out in the fields as well. So there's just really the sense of gender equality that didn't necessarily exist on the East Coast. But then, you know, communities also had to work together. Everybody had to get together to raise the barn, to, you know, take care of the kids, to do any number of, you know, jobs that required more than two or four hands. And that really imbued her with this sense of grassroots democracy, right?
And that was Larissa Reinhart and I talking on stage here at GPB. This was sort of the first event like that I've done. I know you've done a couple.
They're fun, aren't they?
Yeah, they were fun. I really had a good time. We had a studio audience. And we'll talk later about where that particular talk is going to go. But yeah, that's where that was from.
Great. So when did Jeanette Rankin get into politics?
Well, she got into politics when she basically started her life in education. She started out as a teacher, pretty much the only thing that women were allowed to do professional-wise at that time. But then she started reading magazines. She read progressive magazines that talked about the working class and the problems of poverty in big cities, and then she visited a big city. She went to Boston and saw the deplorable conditions in the working class neighborhoods there. She attended Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration, and of course we know Teddy Roosevelt was a big progressive. Then she got into San Francisco and worked at what we might call a collective, a house where people took care of each other with food and health care, and she worked in an orphanage. But all of this led to women's suffrage, and she got involved with organizations that sent her across the West on trains and on horse and buggy to little towns where she would talk in the middle of the street to men, women, anyone who would hear her about why women deserve the right to vote. And as I mentioned, in 1914, she and others convinced enough Montanans to vote for women's suffrage.
Okay, and that was her platform, or did she campaign on something else?
Well, when she ran for Congress in 1916, her platform was mostly an anti-war platform. Now, remember, 1916, the whole world, except the United States at that time, was engaged in a great war. And people saw this war in Europe and said, we don't want our boys coming over there. She was boldly anti-war in that campaign. She believed that pacifism went hand in hand with her progressivism. In other words, you can't have uplifting the working class, you can't have press freedom, you can't have women's suffrage, what we might call expanding democracy. You can't fight against corporate greed, to use modern-day language, unless you have peace. And so that's why she always said, no one wins a war. And she always used to say also, you can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake.
Okay, so there's the title of the book, Winning the Earthquake.
That's where the title of the book comes. So she, with this platform, had a historic win, and she became, for a time, the most famous woman in the world.
Well, I want to go back to the war later on in our conversation, but let me ask you first, how people viewed her when she was elected. Clearly popular at home, what did the rest of the country think?
Well, she became a celebrity. She became talked about instantly. Her phone started ringing and her face was on newspapers around the world. She did have some demeaning coverage, people questioning her fitness for office.
Still happens to women now, unfairly.
Yeah, it's crude, you know, people making crude jokes. I mean, we just have to look at modern day politics to see women being made the subject of crude jokes when they reach high and powerful positions. But mostly it was celebration. It was the novelty. She said, I am the first, but I will not be the last.
And she was right. So elected on an anti-war platform, pushing for the right for women to vote. And then there's war. War happens. So how did she get around that?
So the Lusitania sinks and the tide turns, and, you know, I don't think there's ever been a time in American history, name me one time in American history when America has been attacked and we haven't attacked back. So when the Lusitania sinks, the tide starts to change. Wilson goes for war, and she votes against it. And her vote against the war did not go good for her at all. She was essentially cut off from her friends. And the movement that she helped to create, the women's suffrage movement, turned against her.
And so she believed that if she voted for and if America went to war, a number of other items on the progressive agenda and on suffragist agenda, including democratic reform, reproductive rights, women's health care, would be swept away, you know, in sort of the fire of war. And she was not wrong. At the same time, we didn't see that, right, until many years later. And because of her vote against the war, she was really cut out of the sort of central suffrage circles that she had herself helped to form.
Now, you have to understand, Peter, that at this time, hawkishness among leaders of the suffrage movement was the thing. Suffrage leaders were saying, you know, we don't want to show that we're weak. We want to be pro-military. We want to show that, you know, we can believe in bombs and guns just like everybody else. And they believed that Jeanette Rankin actually hurt them. Mm. They believed that Jeanette Rankin was showing that women were less patriotic. So that's why she was basically cut off from the movement and didn't really get recognized in it until much later in her life.
So that must have been really painful for her. Does the book kind of describe how she felt in that moment?
Yeah, it goes back to her friendships with people who were very close to her, cutting her off. But, you know, we see what happened. It didn't hurt the movement.
Right. Women still got the right to vote in 1920.
Yeah, didn't hurt the moment, but she, by that time, had been gerrymandered out of her district. She just served that one term, and then she gets another term later. But after that, she becomes a lobbyist for various peace organizations and moves to Georgia.
Oh, so there's the Georgia connection.
There's the Georgia connection.
Necessary for this podcast.
Yeah, we got
to
do it.
Where in Georgia?
She moved to Athens, areas around Athens, a university town, so perfect for a free-thinking progressive. She founds a peace organization there. She starts a Boys and Girls Club there. She has a farm there. She lives very simply in a house without electricity or running water, sort of like the ranch back in Montana. And she's starting a job as a lobbyist for various peace organizations. So she has an impact in Georgia, but she's mostly working for these national and international peace groups.
Uh-huh. So she's never elected to Congress from Georgia.
No. She does lobby the legislature for democratic reforms, namely multi-member districts and ranked choice voting and things like that. And she does write to her lawmakers. She becomes a lecturer at Brunel University. But again, her main focus is national and international politics for peace.
Was there any Georgia initiative that she successfully pulled off? Clearly not ranked choice voting. We don't have that now, but...
Unfortunately, I have to say, you know, she did start these nonprofit organizations and have some impact in Georgia, but she was mostly working for these national groups. Her profile was national and international.
Got it. Okay. So she's interested in the national profile. She does make it back to Congress, but not from Georgia, so she must have gone back to her home state.
Yeah, she had to go back. You know, I think the law is you can be elected from a district you don't represent, but you can't be elected from a state that you don't live in.
That,
right?
That is true. Fun fact, I interviewed the son of Bernie Sanders when I lived in New Hampshire, and he lived in New Hampshire, but he was doing just that. He was running in a district he did not live in.
It happens all the time.
Yeah,
it happens
he
here in Georgia. But no, yeah. She did move back to Montana to sort of reestablish her residency. And people remembered her for her work earlier. Keep in mind, now it's 1940. She's 59 years old at this point, and we've got another war looming. And sort of everything that she has worked against is happening again. The drumbeat of war, the drumbeat of patriotism, and she again decides to run on a boldly anti-war platform. And at least to get her elected, it was very popular. She got elected again from Montana in 1940, and then America attacked Pearl Harbor. December 7th, 1941.
A date that will live in infamy.
A date that will live in infamy. And after that speech, she was the only one in Congress to vote against war, for against Japan. I think in World War I vote, there was maybe a couple dozen lawmakers who also voted against the war, World War I. But for World War II, with the vote against Japan, she was the only one. It was her most lonely vote.
So many times in the past when Jeanette's vote has been described, it's been described as the vote of sort of an ornery old woman who didn't understand how the world worked. And as I said, you know, I deeply admire Roosevelt. It was difficult for me to get past this vote. But, you know, in the end, learning this history of the emergence of the military-industrial complex, it was actually an incredibly principled vote and a vote of someone who knew exactly the way the world worked.
It's important to note that after she voted against war with Japan, she voted present, or she didn't vote. She didn't take an anti-war vote on the vote for Germany. But in any case, once war was begun, she always supported the troops. Every appropriation for war, she supported. Her thought was the best way to bring our boys home is to end the war victoriously. So she supported the troops and she supported the war appropriations, but not getting into the war. This vote, though, truly ended her career.
It seemed like simply a protest vote, right? She must have known there was no way.
It was a conscience vote.
Yeah.
How can
those two things can coexist, I think, right? They're protesting the way everything else is going to go?
I think there maybe would have been other people who would have had conscience on their mind in that vote, but they voted for it, you know?
Well, let me back up for a minute. What was meant by the FDR comment in that last clip we heard?
Well, FDR and Jeanette Rankin did not get along at all.
Oh, clearly. Yeah, you can tell.
first of all, FDR was the Secretary of the Navy for a long time, which you might know. And so she had a skepticism about him because of his, you know, promotion of naval arms and stuff like that. And also, FDR didn't exactly warm to suffrage very quickly. So that's another reason why Jeanette Rankin and FDR did not get along. And you know, that sort of conflicts with me, too, because I love FDR. You know, true fact, back in the old days of the first internet in the 1990s, when you can all make an HTML page from your...
make a fan page for FDR?
I made an FDR fan page. Yeah. I made an FDR fan page.
Oh, nerd alert.
And
nerd alert.
I've been to Warm Springs. And just this summer, as you know, I went to Hyde Park to see his home in New York.
Please say you have at least a printout of this FDR webpage that you made.
I don't know. Does the Wayback Machine
I don't
go
know if
back
it works,
that far?
But that's what I'm saying. Like, at least a printout. You have it on a floppy disk somewhere.
see some GIFs. But yeah, I was a big FDR fan. But
so did you get sort of riled up whenever you read a FDR criticism in this book?
No, I understand it. You know, Rankin was anti-war, and FDR was boldly pro-military.
He was provoking conflict before we got into that war, you know, little submarine skirmishes here or there in the North Atlantic
A lot about the war that doesn't get reported or that we don't know very well. Anyways, but that's the end of her political career.
So wild, right? Like, she's out of Congress, but she's got a lot of life left to live. What does she do post-Congress?
All right. So she's now in her 60s. She's traveling the world. She loves to go to India. She retreats back to her farm. She does live a very quiet life.
She back in Georgia?
She's back in Georgia. Yeah, okay. She spends like half of her life in Georgia. Mm. I didn't even know that. The first woman.
Is she buried here?
I don't think so. I'll have to check on that.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that.
An addendum to this podcast coming up.
Yeah, but okay. She spends like half her life here, and I didn't know that. But once the Vietnam War comes, again.
Predictable position on that, right? Anti-war.
Here we come with more war.
But it's a much less popular war.
Yes. Yeah, so she starts marching with Coretta Scott King against the war. She appears on television a time or two to talk about the war. And she really receives some much-deserved accolades and credit at this time. Remember, she's now elderly. She's in her 70s and 80s, but she was denied this recognition when she was at the height of her career. But now, in the golden years of her career, she's getting recognized. She does have health challenges, which I won't get too much into, but at some point, those health challenges force her to go to California, and she dies at age 92. Her legacy today is everything. Someone at that GPB event asked Reinhart what she would ask Jeanette Rankin if she could talk to her. And Reinhart said that she would, first of all, fall down at her feet and thank her for everything that she did.
And then I would ask her, what's your advice for us now? What can we do? You know, she confronted so many of the things that we are confronting, right? Like in her own time in Montana, it was controlled by a corporate oligarchy that owned the economy, most of its newspapers, bribed its legislature, owned its power grid. And yet she was able to persevere and get elected in that environment. How can we harness that idea and that power of grassroots democracy to overcome the problems that we faced? And also, she just was incredible at talking to people who didn't agree with her and finding common ground. And I think that's something we could all benefit in engaging in these days. So that's what I would ask her.
That GPB event was co-hosted by the Jeanette Rankin Foundation, which was established by Jeanette Rankin in her will. It gives scholarships to women over age 35 who are in financial need. So her legacy lives on.
So what gives this book the narrative edge?
I think it engages your senses. You know, we've been talking a lot here about her facts and her biography, but this book engages your senses. The way it's written, there's a sense of place, there's a sense of time. You can imagine the saloons that she's going into to talk to these men to vote for suffrage. You can imagine her, the train whistles that you hear when she's going from town to town. You can feel the tension between her and others, between her and Roosevelt, between her and her friends, between her and everyone who was opposed to her. And there were many who were opposed to her. But she also had this optimism, this determination. And you get all of that from this book. And her life really comes alive. So that's why I recommend it. We hear about the ups and downs in her life. You know, I'm all about Georgia connections to American history, and this was something that came across my desk. I say, got to do it.
Well, that's incredible. Glad you read this book, and glad you had that conversation. The book is called Winning the Earthquake, How Jeanette Rankin Defied All Odds to Become the First Woman in Congress, by Larissa Reinhart. And you can see Orlando and Larissa's full conversation about Jeanette Rankin recorded at GPB on a special edition of this podcast. That's coming soon. Orlando, thanks very much.
Thank you.